Dr. Myrna Milani. She earned her Bachelor of Science degree from Capital University in Columbus, Ohio, and her doctorate in veterinary medicine from the Ohio State University College of Veterinary Medicine, focused on animal behavior. She entered private practice in New Hampshire after she had done a year as a full-time academic advisor to pre-veterinary students at the university that she attended. And her interest is, obviously, as you will find out, in the study of the relationship between humans and animals and how it affects their health and the behavior of both. And she has written a number of books, and some are novels. She has them on her website at www.mmilani.com. That's mmilani.com. She has written The Weekend Dog, The Invisible Leash, The Body Language and Emotion of Dogs, The Body Language and Emotion of Cats, and several other books. And really, you want to go read her blog, because she is an amazing writer as well. And I'm not just saying that. I really enjoy what she writes. And hopefully we're going to talk a little bit about her new article today called Fat Cats and Top Dogs, which I thought that was awesome. But before we get into that, let's just welcome Dr. Milani. I'm so glad you're with us.
Well, I'm very, very happy to be here, though slightly embarrassed after that introduction. I don't know if I can live up to that.
Yes, you definitely do. You do live up to it. Doc, this is a fascinating topic for us. In fact, due in part to your inspiration to both Jeannie and I, and that is not just the human-animal bond in natural animal health, but animal nature, because therein is where I think human beings really straight off the beaten path, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. absolutely big time. And the animals, I think both domestic animals, companion animals as a subset of that, and also the wild animals are paying the price for that.
Right.
You bet they are. They really, really are. Well, I know that because this is your focus and this is such an important topic, your article is going to really talk about that. And I hope you don't mind if I quote from part of that on here, because I was, as always, when I'm reading your blog or your site, I laugh out loud because you're so profound and yet you're very direct. I thought this was fascinating what Dr. Myrna said, so I'm going to quote from here. But she says, and referring to that there are metaphors that we use from the animal world and the human world, and she says, well, although this might be true on the athletic field about referring back to health dog, it's not true within the animal kingdom in the long run. There, the winners are those who get the job done using the least amount of energy. And one thing we can say for sure about fighting is that it uses a lot of energy. Mm-hmm. And worse, the return on that energy investment can be sufficiently low that it would make any thinking investment banker consider a career change. For one thing, no one ever wins a fight. The winner is simply the one who loses the least. And for another, fighting is self-limiting. It's only an effective strategy if you're very strong and your competitor or opponent is very weak. Now, she goes down to say later, so in animal terms, the ideal male and female alphas are the ones who can rise to the top, creating the least amount of stress for themselves and those around them. How different than us? And how we totally don't get the animal nature anymore, Dr. Myrna, because as we said before, we're so far removed from nature. We're so urbanized.
Yes, and this whole idea of the alpha being the winner of the fight, and I hear this time and time again, and I've gotten to the point even, like I used to use the word leadership, talking about with the relationship between humans and dogs. And I was referring to it the way it was originally intended, which was as a model for the relationship between a mature adult dog and a pup. And yet that doggone competitive dominance, it just always sneaks back in. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just that there are a lot of people out there who apparently feel impotent. I don't know how else to say it.
For lack of a better word.
Well, I just remember years ago having this discussion with my grandmother, and it happened to be during an election year, and she just asked a rhetorical question, who seeks power? And her answer was, why, those who feel naturally impotent, who else? And so I look at the same thing that, you know, the people who have to prove that they can control a dog or a horse or another animal, they're missing the point.
Right.
They totally are. And I think you might know, because you know so much about animal behavior, Dr. Myrna, that in the horse world, it's not the dominant horse who's the leader. There's a difference between dominance and leadership.
Yeah. The analogy I use with my clients is that a true alpha is like a person who has a black belt, and all of the philosophy to go with it.
Mm.
They never fight.
Right. And, no, they walk away if they can. Mm-hmm.
And the reason I want my clients to have a canine parental relationship with their dogs, and that's different from a human parental. You know, we got to get that right out up
front. Right.
But the thing about a parental relationship in the domestic arena is that it lasts, whereas a competitive relationship doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I'm being anthropomorphic to use the analogy of myself and my brother and my sister. We will go to our graves competing. I can hit my brother now. I died before you did. Ha 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 ha. Okay? But my mom could be resurrected from the grave in her 95-pound scrawniness, give any one of us the look, and we would buckle.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, she was a leader.
Yeah, and that's forever. And
right.
The thing is that that's what I want for my clients. And the reality is that a lot of training methods were developed for trainers. They like to train.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that they are on an ongoing training with their dogs, with the dog's entire life, that appeals to them. But it doesn't appeal to the average person. And so because of that, to me, it's worth it to make this kind of a more equitable emotional investment up front rather than try to backtrack later.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm-hmm. So in that thought, how have human emotions towards animals changed over the years? It's not a question so much as have they, but how have they?
Yeah, there's been a change both in the kind of emotion and also the intensity. And when I was thinking about this, it just so happened that somebody sent me a poem by Walt Whitman. So we're talking about the mid-1800s. And it's a short poem, and it's called Dumb Delights. And when I read this poem, I was thinking about a dog back in the 1850s and a lot of the dogs I see who obviously have problems or I wouldn't be seeing them.
Okay.
And his poem goes like this. I think I could turn and live with animals. They're so placid and self-contained. I stand and look at them long and long. They do not sweat and whine about their condition. They do not lie awake in the dark and weep for their sins. They do not make me sick disgusting their duty to God. Not one is dissatisfied. Not one is demented with the mania of owning things. Not one kneels to another nor to his kind that lived thousands of years ago. Not one is respectable or industrious over the whole earth. Well, he's certainly not talking about my patient base. You know? They ain't placid. They ain't self-contained. They whine. Mm-hmm. They lie awake at night. They pace. They weep. Some of them are demented with the mania possessive.
Right.
You know, but that was the emotion back then. And that was the animal was the animal. It was self-contained, separate from us with its own needs.
Mm-hmm.
Then if we jump forward, and a big, big jump here, that gave way to what I think of as the era of guilt. Back in the 70s when women went back into the workforce, and then the predominant emotion then was guilt. Again, this was very similar to what working mothers experience.
Indeed,
if I hadn't been working, the baby never would have gotten sick.
Right.
If I had been home, she wouldn't be dyslexic or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So we had that era, and then that gave away with the increased trend toward purebred animals who were going to solve all the problems because of their breeding and also rescue. Then we went into the era of unconditional love.
Mm-hmm.
All we have to, as long as we love them and they loved us unconditionally, what could possibly go wrong?
Oh,
and then,
boy.
Yeah. And then where we are now, and this is a pretty recent phenomena for me. Lately, I have encountered more and more clients who, when their animals develop problems, they speak of feeling betrayed. That interested me because at first I thought they felt that they were betrayed by the dog. And some of them did feel this way. They took it very personally if the dog bit someone.
Mm.
But that wasn't most of them. There was another small group. They felt betrayed by the rescue organization or the shelter that implied that all this animal needed was a little bit of love and, you know, everything would straighten out. But I think for the bulk of these people, they felt betrayed by the illusion.
Hmm.
The illusion of?
The illusion of dogs and other animals as the symbols on whom we projected our emotions. So it was all of a sudden they discovered that, oh, holy cow, there's a dog standing behind that mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a tough one. When you're talking about maybe having to face lifelong treatment for medical problems,
right,
or serious behavioral problems that are going to require major changes in the way you think, in your household, and you feel betrayed.
Wow.
And
I think what you said it very well in that article, Dr. Myrna. You said you seek to help your clients animalize their bond space.
Yeah.
And that's important because what we're doing is the exact opposite.
Exactly.
And we're giving ourselves points for it.
Yeah.
I know. And you know, that's not to negate the intelligence of the animal. One of the things I catch myself repeating over and over like a mantra is the dignity for a dog lies in treating him as a dog.
Exactly.
Or a horse is a horse. When you can communicate with a horse or a bird or a prey animal, especially because with these predator animals, we're predators, so it's a little bit different. But with the prey animals, it's because you've understood their nature enough to become a horse, to communicate with a horse. And that sounds really goofy, but it's not. You're talking about animalizing our bond space. You're talking about animalizing, becoming like that in order to be able to communicate effectively.
And it's hard work,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it's particularly with social animals, that relationship is dynamic.
Right.
And
mm-hmm.
the animal is changing and their needs are changing just like we're changing and our needs are changing. And then over this whole complex of what is going on in our daily life, if you will, with our domestic animals, and particularly our companion animals, our dogs, our cats, and our horses, we are consciously or subconsciously breeding them for more and more infantile features,
mm-hmm.
and we're getting the behavior and the physiology that goes with that. And
good point.
And we're on a collision course because
yeah, we are.
Yeah, because the animals are getting more and more physiologically and behaviorally immature at the same time as the demands that we're placing on them are becoming more and more complex.
Mm.
Wow, that's not a good mix. That's
no.
like creating the perfect storm.
Right.
Well, it is, and you toss in the shrinking gene pool, and particularly dogs from 50 years of spay and neuter, and that's a factor. You know, it just brings me back to my dream of someday winning the Publisher's Clearinghouse sweepstakes so I could start the filthy rich animal think tank so we could think about them before we do them, you know, instead of after the fact.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, in this whole process, as we're talking about this, because really what we're working here, Dr. Myrna, to help people understand animal nature, and that's tough, like you said, because even how we feed them is really a struggle with people today. So where do the animals' emotions fit into all this?
Well, the thing about the animals' emotions is that we know that they have receptors in the same parts of the brain that we do for emotion. Okay, so we know that they have them.
Right.
The problem is that they don't perceive their world the same way we do.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't say what emotions they experience or how they experience them. And where we get into trouble is that a lot of times we assign emotions to animals based on what we think we would feel
right.
under the same circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
That's absolutely right. We do. Mm-hmm.
And that can be problematic. I'll defer to you two experts on equine behavior, but I know, you know, for a fact in both human and canine behavior, context is absolutely everything. And you can take two behaviors and they can have absolutely opposite meaning.
Sure.
So, for example, the dog that comes running up to you at the door and is wagging his tail like crazy and he's all over you. he could be saying, yes, I am really happy to see you. Or he could be saying, I am scared to death, but I don't want to fight. I can't fight. So I'm going to just try to close the distance between us. And you need to know the context.
Right.
And unfortunately, if you don't know the context, if you think, oh, anytime a dog does that, that means he loves me. You can have some real breakdowns in communication here. You can create stress for that animal, and then that in turn can lead to medical problems.
Isn't that indicative, though, of why we're seeing all these insane draconian laws come into being?
Yes. I mean, there is so much emotion out there. I mean, the things like the breed ban or in California, they just passed that, that horrendous, 4-month ban.
Right.
Yeah. And then that's another thing. You're putting, and this is a passionate topic for us, but you're putting the emphasis on the animal. And, you know, you're punishing the animal for something that humans have been irresponsible in.
Exactly. And I think, you know, one of the things that has happened, and I know I'm not here to talk about spay and neuter, but...
That's okay.
But it always comes up.
You know, it all boils down to reproduction. I mean, that's the biological raison d'etre, as we say. But what I hate to see happen, aside from the implications for the various breeds and the canine species itself, is this idea that what we have done is we have traded in euthanizing puppies in shelters a lot of times, or by veterinarians. Okay, so by people who have made a choice to go into those professions and who have been trained to do this. We have traded in that for a population of well-loved family pets who are succumbing to various diseases way before their time. So that when I first went into practice many years ago, it was fashionable to sneer at people who got a dog or a cat and they let them have young so that their offspring, their kids, could see the miracle of birth.
Right.
Okay, now we've raised a whole generation of kids out there who have seen their dog die. Watched their dog die of cancer, watched their dog fade away because of hip dysplasia. The dog can't play with them because of hip or knee problems, or see the Rottweiler die of osteosarcoma.
Yeah.
What about behavioral problems as well?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And is that the message?
Wow.
You know, that we want to give our kids?
I think you alluded to that, Dr. Myrna. You did say that this is pretty much a fear-based knee-jerk reaction to lack of knowledge.
Right. And this is thing called the foghorn theory. The less people can see, the more noise they make.
Right.
And I think what happens with these people sometimes, again, the animal is a symbol to them. And so you and I might be talking about dogs or cats or horses, but they're talking about something quite different. It could be an abusive childhood that they had, and so now they're projecting that on animals, that no animal is ever going to have to experience what they experienced. There's something like that. And this makes any kind of meaningful dialogue extremely difficult. I'm really fortunate in that here in New England, well, first of all, we did such a bang-up job on spay and neuter that we are now dealing with the consequences big time.
And could you elaborate on what you mean by that, just for semantic sake?
A lot of our local shelters, well, we don't have any puppies.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. Could you say that again? I want everyone to hear that.
We do not have any local puppies. We have adult dogs, then a lot of them have problems. I mean, that's just the starting point that I think anyone who adopts a dog, an adult dog from a shelter or a rescue group, should go in there with the idea that this animal could have problems.
And that's because of the spay neuter being done too young, right?
That's part of it.
Okay.
So the other thing that has happened here then, you know, dogs are like drugs. We need them. Dogs are probably even better than drugs, right?
Oh, they are.
I mean, we have co-evolved for thousands and thousands of years to affect each other's heart rate, blood pressure, triglycerides, our sense of well-being. We co-evolved.
Yep.
So you can't just say, well, you can't have that. And so now...
No, they can't tell us that. They will not tell us that.
They do tell us that, but they can't.
So then their linear approach to this was, well, you guys don't have any puppies, and down south, they've got tons of nice puppies. So now there are thousands of dogs that are being shipped from down south to New England to other metropolitan areas that do not have any puppies.
Boy.
And some of these animals, they are, well, some of them are taken away from the mothers. Some of these shelters, they just have drop-off boxes.
You know, they still have those?
They do here, Jeannie.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so,
I know.
So the shelter workers come to work in the morning, and there's a box there with eight puppies
animals
in it.
Stuck in there, right?
Oh, yeah, and they might only be 5-6 weeks old. So I have seen animals up here taken away from their moms, put into foster care, vaccinated, wormed, spayed, neutered, shipped, up for adoption, and in their new homes by 8 weeks of age.
Oh, my goodness.
You're kidding me. They've been spayed and neutered.
Talk about behavioral problems.
I mean, this is the big push in all the shelters is not...
That's a crime. That should be a crime.
Well, yeah, but it's really interesting, though, that if you say anything about this, as I know from saying things about this on my
website, as do we.
You get hate mail.
Sure. You do.
Oh, yeah.
You really
do.
And
yeah.
I'm going to be interested to see what happens in the newest journal of the American Veterinary Medical Association. Big study. Over 1 million dogs. And,
really?
Yep. And they looked at hip dysplasia and knee problems.
Wow.
And guess what the big factor was? The primary factor.
I know what you're going to say.
Yeah.
The gonadectomy.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Here's the thing, and this is the hate mail that I've gotten from certain animal control people, is that, well, we'd rather see animals spayed and neutered than dead. And I said, well, I mean, you're just killing them slowly.
Slowly,
with
right.
This.
What they're saying is, we don't care as long as we don't have to kill them.
Right.
If the owners have
to
kill them.
But they are killing them if they do this too young.
Yeah, but see, it's not their problem.
Right, and they don't have to watch them die.
Then it becomes the owner who has to, with grief, watch their animal grow sicker and die and old and problems by the age of 3 or 2 or whatever.
Right,
when,
and exactly with this long-standing relationship with them.
Mm.
And there was another article in the AVMA Journal, I think it was last November, that did a survey of all of the reproductive hormone-related type articles out there. It's not all-inclusive, but it was pretty good. And the first conclusion of this actually inspired me to fire off a letter, because the first conclusion was that the shelters have to do pediatric spay and neuter because they're dealing with a population.
Yeah.
But their recommendation to veterinarians was, if you are dealing with somebody's pet, then you counsel them on a case-by-case basis. And talk about ironic, if they're responsible owners, then you might suggest that they delay it. So now we've gone from, if you're responsible, you spay and neuter them, and, you know, linear thinking, the sooner the better.
Yeah.
And now it's going to the opposite extreme. And the thing I wrote to the journal was that I had severe ethical problems with it. I mean, how could I, as a veterinarian, say to a client who had gone through problems with a dog, look, why don't you be a good doobie and go and adopt a dog from a shelter?
Yeah.
How can I do that?
Right.
You know, there is a lot of emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And it is very emotional, simply because of what you said, how we've co-evolved. And one of the things that, again, I keep referring back to this article, and you are such a profound writer, it just kind of strikes me as I go back and read over and over. But you say that because of this, the real challenge for us is learning to communicate with them in their own language. And I honestly said in that article that we told you about, Come to the Edge, that the whole thing is, what if we could just ask animals? I don't think they'd be on the same page with us with all this stuff.
No.
I don't think they would either. And in terms of anthropomorphic, maybe it might be. But if my cat came up to me and put his little paw around my shoulder and said, hey, come on, let's you and me mosey out and rustle up some rodents for dinner. Or, hey, you don't need your ovaries.
Right.
what the heck, you know, what do you need them for?
What do you need them for, yeah.
Well, actually, given my age now, my pets know doggone well what I needed them for, and they sure know when it's not there. You know? Oh, my God, wedding again. You know, I think this idea that it doesn't matter, I think that's what bothers me
right.
most.
Yeah.
That it's too, I don't know. And it's not even like it's too hard to learn about them. It's
no.
that it doesn't even come up on the screen as a possibility. And I see this across the media. You know, references to animals as if they actually knew what they were talking about, and it's mind-boggling.
Yeah, it is.
It's absolutely mind-boggling to me.
And the media, I have to say something here. I'm not real sure they know much about much because true journalism has been out the window. And that said, I don't lay much credence in what they say, but what's really frightening is the majority of people do.
That's it right there.
Yes.
We've dumbed everybody down to the point that they believe anything they hear anymore. And usually from the media, not even from somebody in authority or an expert.
And sad for us, animals sell.
Mm-hmm.
And they make good, animals make for good television. And I could probably get a PhD analyzing dog or cat related segments on YouTube if I could stomach it.
Mm.
You know? Because,
yeah.
you know, I can see.
Gosh, you're sounding like us, Dr. Murray.
Well, you know, and it's so hard because, I mean, some of these, they're very creative. And if you don't know anything about animal behavior, they are funny.
Sure.
But if you know something about animal behavior and you realize how stressed these animals are.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
Then.
Exactly.
Then it's like, what are we doing here?
What are we doing? And, you know, I go back all the time to horses because horses, I think, are one of the most demonstrative animals when they're stressed out, partly because they're big enough to watch, if you know anything about their nature. And secondly, because they have just been treated like beasts of labor and machinery for so long, and yet still prevails. And everything about how we've raised them is so contrary to their nature.
Yeah.
And I also look back at what's going on with dogs. You know, this dog biting and dangerous dog thing
right.
and anti-breed thing.
Oh.
And all of that smacks to me of a lack of knowledge on animal, on dog nature.
Mm-hmm.
Dogs warn you. Dogs have body language going on all the time that tells you what exactly where they're going with that. If we would go back to nature and look at how they interact socially within their own species.
And that, too, is the breed bands are an excellent example of emotion, human emotion, and the self-fulfilling prophecy, too. Because the original article that was in the American Veterinary Medical Association that is it's used by the Communicable Disease and Prevention Centers. It's been quoted time and time again, and it put pit bulls at the top of the list in fatal dog attacks.
Hmm.
Well, you know, that just sells newspapers and television,
oh, yeah.
too.
Well, the problem with it is that the statistical analysis was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
what they did
it was blatantly
in the original
wrong.
Study is they just compared the number of pit bulls in the study to the number of dogs of other breeds in that same study instead of the total population.
Oh, mm-hmm.
If you actually run the numbers, you're more likely to get killed by a Basenji.
Right.
But once that got into the media, then it just took on a life of its own.
It sure did.
And
but that's what happens when they get hold of some. Still hear people who don't know much about animals, although they might be in the same industry as Jeannie and I, that actually they repeat what they've heard and think it to be true, Dr. Myrna. I mean, they honestly believe it to be gospel fact.
And then
in fact, it's not.
And then once that happens, particularly with aggression, then you're in a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, you are.
You know,
yeah.
you've got the scared pit bull, and then the person sees that dog, and they get that, and their heart rate goes up, their blood pressure goes up, their rank goes down. Now they're signaling submission to the dog. At the same time, they might be establishing eye contact,
right.
talking in some stupid, twittery, high-pitched, whiny voice, and reach out for the top of the dog's head. So basically, to this dog, this person must be like, if a totally mad person came up to you, it's like, what is this? Is this this person is obviously crazy.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I can't trust them.
They're in my
until the dog's going to defend itself.
Sure.
Yeah. So that whole thing is really interesting. There's part of me, I admit, sort of sick part of me, that same thing will happen here that happened in England. And what happened in the UK is they had this big flap about dangerous breeds and dangerous breed legislation. So then what happened was, I guess it came up before Parliament, and they had the Rottweilers and the German Shepherd dogs on there and the pit bulls.
And the Dobermans and the usual, the Mastiffs, yeah.
But, you know, when you have an aristocracy, well, they wanted their Rottweilers because that was their primary state dog. So the Rottweilers went, and law enforcement wanted the German Shepherd dogs, so they went. So then what they were left with was the pit bulls, and that seemed sort of pathetic. So then they threw the Tosas on there, and I think there was like one Tosa in the UK at the time, and some other dog that there weren't any of. But then, and I don't know if you remember this, but there was like some little, like a 4-year-old who shoved his 2-year-old brother out the window.
Oh my God, no, I don't.
And what happened is that just completely took over the media.
Mm.
And the dogs vanished.
Wow.
And so then all of the focus shifted to kids and,
mm-hmm.
and parents and stuff, just like that.
Wow.
And that was just such a good indicator of how much of this was being driven by emotion and by sales.
Right.
And even relative to the pit bull, here's a vet tech, and I apologize, I can't remember her name, who went to a tremendous amount of effort to track down all of the news stories that included pit bulls.
Mm-hmm.
And what she found was that there were cases out there where the dog involved was actually a retriever mix, and the breed was changed because it would be more likely to be picked up by the wire service.
Okay, that just really gets my hackles up, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
But that's what it's all about. It's about
it is.
Sales.
But there's no truth there, Dr. Myrna. That's not about any kind of truth. That's just about selling papers or selling media or selling advertising.
Yeah. It's
all, and I tell people this all the time, economic, plain and simple.
Yeah.
Simple things, and I know this has to go with everything. We talk about the health of the animals when, you know, we have people saying, well, we'll buy a dog from a puppy from a pet store and save that life. But what people fail to understand is economics are driven by demand. And economics, as long as somebody's buying those animals out of those stores, there will always be those puppies.
Right.
I don't care how many you think you're saving, you will constantly be supporting that and perpetuating that ill health and that terrible, the poor breeding and perpetuating the dog problems or whatever into society. So it's a vicious catch-22. Got to get people out of that, off that merry-go-round.
That's a tough issue, too, because just to play devil's advocate here, because it is driven by economics, those puppies in the puppy mill, they have been stressed. There's no question about it.
Sure.
Yeah.
But the thing is, if they can't deal with that stress, those breeders are not going to breed them, right?
Mm.
Because they know they're going to get them back again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, compare that to a breeder who keeps puppies and has to keep puppies under very, very secure conditions and maybe with, you know, tremendous amount of veterinary assistance just to get those puppies to 8 weeks of age.
Mm.
You know, so we have that.
Yeah, that's true, too.
So, this is another place for the Filthy Rich Animal Think Tank.
Yes.
We need that filthy rich animal think tank.
We got to find someone who's filthy rich.
Yeah, we need a great philanthropist who wants the mindset get changed, because that's our last question we can focus on is, what are we going to do about all this?
What can we do?
Yeah.
You know, relative to the medical problems and the kinds of behavioral and medical problems that emotions precipitate in animals are absolutely legion. And what we need to do is that we have to treat the underlying cause, which is those human emotions.
Okay, so you're talking about the root cause, and you know, when we talk about natural health, we always say, go to the root cause, and that's exactly the same thing.
And that is what we're talking about.
Yes.
Because if a person has a relationship with an animal that the animal cannot tolerate, and that results in stress, and that elevates cortisol, that elevates insulin-like growth factor, okay, we are setting that animal up. We're taxing the adrenal glands, we're taxing the thyroid, we're taxing the pancreas, and we can wind up with nonspecific gut problems, pancreatic insufficiency. In little breeds where they have less insulin-like growth factor to begin with, we can be setting them up for diabetes. So to just treat the effects without treating that relationship, you're not going to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's like
good
taking
point.
The dog who is jumping up on everybody when they come home because that dog is stressed, and you use a clicker training to teach the dog not to jump.
Mm-hmm.
The stress is still there, and it's got to go somewhere.
Yes.
And I think what's been happening is the behavioral and the medical communities have been trading these problems back and forth. So, you know, the trainers deal with the jumping, and then the next thing the dog has irritable bowel. Well, that's
right.
A medical problem. That's not their problem.
Mm-hmm.
Or
yikes, that's a mess.
Big vicious cycle.
It is. It absolutely is. And so
now we need human training now. We need to train humans.
You know, I have this standing challenge for all my veterinary friends and trainer friends, and that is give me one medical or behavioral problem that does not have the opposite component as well as a bond component. There is none.
Can you repeat that for the listeners?
Okay, that the challenge is show me a medical problem in an animal that is strictly a medical problem that does not affect that animal's relationship with the owner or vice versa.
No such thing, because it's all interdependent.
Right.
Exactly. And the same thing is true of behavioral problems, and the same thing is true with bond problems. You cannot change one without changing the other.
Wow.
When we teach people, even about in human health, how the mind, body, spirit, everything's interdependent. But that's what you're saying right here. It's all interdependent, and you can't separate one from the other, and you can't isolate.
The only way you can do it is for your own convenience.
Well, there you go. That's it right there in a nutshell.
You know, but relative to reality, no. And because of that, the animal's going to suffer, and the person is going to suffer, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, if you look at, as a veterinarian, most clients, they call for appointments, not for physical reasons, but for behavioral and bond reasons. The dog,
really?
Yeah. The dog is coughing. They don't like the cough. It keeps them up at night. It irritates them. They yell at the dog. It makes them feel guilty. So they call, and they make the appointment, and they want the cough stopped.
Mm-hmm.
But what does the veterinarian think? The veterinarian's first response is, what is causing the cough? And $300 of diagnostics later, the client calls up and says, well, what's going on? And the veterinarian says, well, I did yabbity, 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 and I discovered yabbity, 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 yabbity. And the client says, is he still coughing?
About
the veterinarian say, well, geez, haven't done a damn thing about that yet.
Right.
So it's coming from two different points of view.
Yes.
Therein lies the rub. Got to find a place. Meeting of the mind somewhere there.
Right.
I don't know what that is, but.
Well, I do know at the end of Dog Smart, I described an at-home physical, and I developed that to be a physical behavioral and bond.
I mean, this is a book of yours, right? Your dogs, that they can get on, and they can order on your website, I hope.
I like
everybody,
that,
please.
You know, one never knows with publishers. But the whole idea, I mean, just simple things like looking in a dog's eyes and ears and opening the dog's mouth and running your hand over that dog's body, and just lifting that dog 1 or 2 inches off the table or off the floor. That is a tremendous. That tells you so much about that dog's behavior. And it tells you so much about how that dog relates to you. And so my theory, which I haven't been able to sell anyone.
I don't know. We're listening.
Well, I don't see any reason why this cannot be incorporated into every physical exam.
Why couldn't it be? And it should be, actually. I mean, okay, so now you have two believers, Dr. Myrna. I can't speak for Gina, but I can hear her.
Oh, yeah.
But you know what's really interesting about this is that in my experience, large animal veterinarians, food animal veterinarians, they have a better handle on this.
They absolutely do. And I'm not saying that to negate you, because you actually do. But yes, they do. And it's for the same reasons that we've been talking about, in their observant nature.
Yeah. And they are aware of it. And they are also aware of, granted, sometimes it's economic importance to the farmer, but they still incorporate that client, that bond dimension into everything they do.
Mm-hmm.
And they're much more attuned I think, to subtle changes, behavioral changes, and probably because if they miss something, they could have a herd health problem.
Right.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
You know, there could be 30 or 50 or 100 cattle that they could be exposing.
Mm-hmm.
So that there is that factor, too. The other thing is that when you're doing farm animal work, you're not so technologically dependent.
Right.
And that has become an issue, too. And this is, and it's the same in human medicine.
You're not the first veterinarian I've heard say that, and I'm talking more of the veterinarians that have been around for a while, long enough to have gotten past the initial training into the real world and are seeing, and of course then using those that are using, like you say, common sense and logic, and it's not jiving with the training and with all the technology.
Right.
So then you go back to basics, which is really where, if we would all go back to our roots, back to the root of everything, there would be where we would begin to see improvement.
Because I know my training was never, ever do a test to prove the problem. To prove what's the problem.
Wow.
Always use your test to confirm what you already believe.
Mm-hmm.
Prove from a thorough physical and a complete history.
Well, I think that's flip-flop, Doctor.
I was going to say, I think they lost that somewhere along the line.
Well, they lost it when the manufacturers of the technology and the drugs became financial supporters, because the support was not there from the public.
Right.
There you go. That's true.
That's a big issue, too.
Sure it is.
It is.
Well, and I think the thing is, as I know from my clients, the ones who do, the rewards are just so phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you do consulting, don't you? It's the Tipping Point Animal Behavior Consulting Services.
Right. And I deal with things like behavioral problems, and I am pretty much limited to companion animals, dogs and cats, just because that's where the bulk of my
Right, sure.
And also stress-related medical problems, you know, bond issues, people dealing with mental illness.
Dr. Myrna, do you do consultations by phone, or are those only for your local clients?
I also do them by phone.
Good.
Okay, so people can contact you at mmmilani.com and consult with you.
Yep.
Great.
We need to duplicate you, you know, like...
Yes.
Do you have a duplication process? I think your animal think tank would be a wonderful duplication thing that we would need to get out there and have you as head of. And we hope that there's somebody out there listening that hears what we're saying. We need Dr. Myrna's think tank.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
for sure.
Just, you know, you see these problems, and my background's prevention.
Exactly.
It's boring, but it's so much cheaper in the long run.
I think prevention is definitely, you know, that old saying about how it's the best medicine, prevention, and you know, the ounce of prevention is far worth more than the pound of cure.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as a pound of cure, really. Prevention is the best way to go.